Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Escapist fiction is not exactly the hottest item these days, unless by escape you mean getting the heck off Earth. Dystopian fiction is on fire right now, full of awful imagined futures that don't require that much imagination. A world transformed by climate change, civil war, memory-eating microbes. This hour On Point, the new boom in dystopian fiction. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is this what you're reading now? Dark tales of humanity living in the rubble of its own mistakes? Why do you think dystopian novels are doing so well nowadays? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A special welcome to our new listeners on WHYY in Philadelphia and beyond today. Welcome aboard. We are delighted to have you. It's not only new dystopian fiction that's doing well out there. Some of the oldies but still scaries have come back as well. George Orwell's dystopian 1984 rocketed to the top of Amazon's bestseller list after the election of Donald Trump. Here's a CBS News report from January.
1984 is currently number one on Amazon's bestseller list. And the book's publisher, Signet, says it's printing 75,000 new copies to keep up with demand. Sales are up 9,500% since last Friday.
1984 at the top of the bestseller list on Amazon in the year 2017. And it's not just that, older one. Margaret Atwood's 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale, is now a Hulu miniseries. It's due out later this month. It's set in the near future. The U.S. is now, in this imagined future, a theocratic military dictatorship called the Republic of Gilead. Women have been stripped of all rights. There's a class of women called handmaids who are kept under guard and forced to bear children for the powerful. Elizabeth Moss plays handmaid Offred. Here she is recalling how the dictatorship came about.
I was asleep before. That's how we let it happen. When they slaughtered Congress, we didn't wake up. When they blamed terrorists and suspended the Constitution, we didn't wake up then either. Now I'm awake.
Oh boy, now I'm awake. Alexandra Altra joins us from New York. She's with the New York Times, covers the publishing industry, and has been writing very recently about this. You can link to her latest work at our website, onpointradio.org. Alexandra Altra, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk about some of these books and their plots, but how does it happen that publishers all get the same bug at the same time? Is there a real wave here?
There is a wave, and it's funny. It happens in publishing the same way it happens in the rest of the entertainment industry. In TV or film, something takes off, and suddenly everyone's on the lookout for the next The Hunger Games or Divergent kind of series. But, you know, dystopian has been popular for a long time. Of course, there were those huge young adult blockbuster series like The Hunger Games, which sold tens of millions of copies and were turned into massive film franchises. Even a couple of years ago, there was this wave of quieter dystopian novels that were kind of more literary, but also dealt with issues that are making us anxious right now, climate change and, you know, economic inequality and the collapse of democratic norms. And that was already happening. And I think this latest crop is incredibly interesting because it's coming, you know, at this moment when our country is incredibly polarized politically and all these issues are sort of right at the surface. And so even though many of the writers started these books years ago and never anticipated what would happen with the 2016 election, they're sort of resonating in a different way now than they would have if they came out last year or the year before.
We'll look at the new ones. What about the classics that have come back? I mean, we've got 1984 out again in hardback, Handmaid's Tale out again in hardback. How unusual is that?
That's incredibly unusual. So 1984, as you mentioned in the beginning of your show, shot to the top of the bestseller list in January, just a few weeks after the election of Donald Trump. And the publisher, the paperback publisher of 1984, has reprinted 550,000 copies, which is really astonishing. In a typical year, the book sells about 400,000 copies. It's, you know, it's it's a novel that's a classic. It's taught in high schools and in colleges. So they have a very strong sale, you know, annual sales for it typically, but they've already reprinted more than they sell in an entire year just to meet demand. Similarly, for The Handmaid's Tale, those sales have shot up. They have reprinted 320,000 copies in 2017 so far. And part of that, I think, is, of course, the television show. People mm-hmm. are excited about that. But you also see people really connecting the themes in that book to what they see happening in politics right now. There were a lot of women at the Women's March in January carrying signs that referenced The Handmaid's Tale, signs that said things like, "Make Margaret Atwood fiction again."
Please, 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 I guess. Alexander Alter, please stand by there in New York with The Times. David Higgins joins us right now as well from St. Paul, Minnesota. He is speculative fiction editor for the Los Angeles Review of Books, scholar of science fiction, teaches English at Inverhills Community College in Minnesota. David Higgins, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
In this new crop, and we'll talk about them, American War and The Book of Joan, Void Star, NK3, New York 2140, and right on down, what are the themes at work here? Are there common kind of nightmares coming to pass, David?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. In your introduction, Tom, I think you said a lot of these dystopian stories are about awful futures. But I think in many ways, a lot of them are about kind of looking at the awful present and imagining that that awful present is going to continue on forward. There's this sort of sense I think you can feel in a lot of this literature that, you know, it's not just that something bad might happen down the road, but that bad things defined in very different ways are happening now, and that there's a feeling of powerlessness around stopping them. So a lot of these dystopian books, I think, are kind of saying, here's what this is going to look like as we continue to go down this path. Or maybe here's what this already looks like now if we pay attention to it closely enough.
We've got Alexander Alter quoting one of the authors here, Lydia Yukhnovich. Alexander, if I got that right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, with The Book of Joan, talking about, you know, she says, current aims have simply played out to their logical conclusions in a lot of these books. Endless war, environmental degradation, the exploitation of Earth as a resource, the brutal stratification of humanity. Alexander, begin to take us into one of these. You talked a bit with Omar El-Akkad, who has written American War. I want to really look at it. Give us the plot line first, and we'll dig on in. But what happens in American War?
American War envisions a second civil war breaking out in the country. It starts in 2074, and it's over fossil fuel use. There's the North and the South again divided. The South wants to continue to use fossil fuels, and the North has renounced them. There's an assassination. There are suicide bombings. There are drone killings. And what's fascinating about it is, as I spoke to Omar about it, he was a reporter at the Globe and Mail for over a decade and covered the war in Afghanistan. He covered the treatment of terrorism suspects at Guantanamo and at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. And so his goal was simply to kind of invert what the normal geopolitics are at the moment, which is, you know, America's kind of involved in these wars overseas. They don't really affect us here. We know these bad things are happening, but it's all taking place very far away. And his vision was to sort of invert that and look at what would happen if those same tactics were being used here, sectarian warfare, you know, really killing, you know, people that would have been your neighbors in other circumstances. So he really wasn't trying to envision the future so much as sort of look at if history had played out a different way. And it's interesting, there's even a foreign global power, the Bouazizi Empire that he envisions. It's a Middle Eastern empire that arises after several Arab Springs take place. And that empire is now kind of affecting American politics and sowing divisions and things like that, similarly to the way our country has been involved in sectarian issues and warfare that we don't necessarily understand how they'll play out once we get involved. So he was a fascinating person to talk to because he had all that experience, but he was also kind of perplexed by what has happened, you know, since he finished the book. He started writing the novel in 2014, finished it in 2015, and he said he wasn't attempting at all to be prescient about polarization in American politics, but it just happened to kind of play out that way. I think there are some issues that he was certainly looking at as far as how the future might look, and that's climate change. In his novel, there are global climate refugees that have kind of retreated from the coast because, you know, Florida's underwater, half of Louisiana is underwater. And so you have these Americans who are now refugees because their land is uninhabitable. You have love, resentment in the center of the country from people who don't want to absorb all these refugees. And so this is something he's reported on, too, climate change. So he was really looking at, you know, if we continue to do things the way we're doing them, what the country might look like.
American War by Omar El-Akkad. As Alexandra summarizes it for the New York Times, it takes place in the southern United States toward the end of this century, after a civil war has broken out over fossil fuel use, the South insisting on using it, and then the country divides. Protagonist, a girl named Sarat, has fled with her family to a refugee camp near the Tennessee border. She's recruited and radicalized by a rebel leader with ties to a Middle Eastern empire that's emerged as a global superpower as the U.S. is collapsing into chaos. David Higgins, memorable moments from American War?
Yeah, well, you know, for one, it's sort of, there's one aspect of this book that's a little bit ironically utopian, which is the idea that, you know, the American Congress would pass legislation that would do something about fossil fuel emissions. But that aside, I think that, you know, what's
that half the country then rejects and breaks off to fight, I guess.
Yeah. Of course, yeah. But I think that the basic premise is perhaps the least realistic. But in terms of what strikes me about it, I think that, you know, in addition to all the great things that that Alexandra said, I think that, you know, one of the things that this book does is it asks Americans to identify with. I think it's a lot like Man in the High Castle, Philip K. Dick's classic novel that's now been that Amazon TV show that's on. It sort of asks Americans to imagine what it would be like if they were, you know, on the other side of things that are happening in the world right now. You know, some of the most striking moments that we've got here are, you know, what it's like to be an undocumented refugee trying to cross borders.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the dystopian fiction flooding the book market right now, publishers and readers going for novels of this world gone wrong. Alexandra Alter has been writing about it for the New York Times. She's with us today from New York. David Higgins is here from St. Paul, Minnesota. He writes for the Los Angeles Review of Books about speculative fiction. Editor there, teaches English at Inverse Hills Community College in Minnesota. Here's a scene. It's not just books. I mean, it's all over if you turn your screens on as well. A little flavor of it here from there. An episode of Black Mirror, acclaimed series. In this dystopia, citizens live in an underground city, spend their days on stationary bikes, generating the power that runs their society. The elites live above ground. The citizens all watch or participate in a show along the lines of America's Got Talent. Bing, the protagonist, tricks his way onto the stage of the game show and demands to speak to the masses about what's wrong with their world. And the game show host relents.
Speak! I haven't got a speech. I didn't plan words. I didn't even try to. I just knew I had to get here, to stand here, and I knew I wanted you to listen. To really listen, not just pull a face like you're listening, like you do the rest of the time. A face like you're feeling instead of processing. La-dee-da, we sing and dance and tumble around, and all you see up here, it's not people. You don't see people up here, it's all fodder. And the faker the fodder is, the more you love it, because fake fodder is the only thing that works anymore. Fake fodder is all that we can stomach. Actually, not quite all. Real pain, real viciousness, that we can take.
Fake fodder sounds pretty desperate in Black Mirror. You can join us this hour. Are you generally a dystopian fiction reader, or have you been drawn to it lately? And why are publishers and readers lining up for books of chaos and doom? Alexandra, David, stand by. Courtney's calling from New Orleans. Courtney, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think?
Hi. I'm really excited to hear about some of the dystopian novels that I haven't read yet. And there's a few that I've read that aren't on, like The Water Thief. That came out about a year and a half ago, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about the power of art, the importance of words and film in getting points across to the public on important issues. You know, sometimes we get a point through art that we don't get through listening to the news, because obviously the facts are out there. But how many people have time in their lives to pay attention to all the facts? I try to pay attention, but it's a full-time job, and I'm still not alert to everything.
And given your life experience and what you see, is it hard for you to project forward and fear some of these outcomes, Courtney?
Not at all. I was here at Katrina in New Orleans, and watching the social breakdown was just incredible. And the town, for years, was like a war zone. It was just like being on the front lines of a war zone. And it took some years. I mean, at about 10 years, we started to normalize. But it took a long time. And right about that time, I saw Children of Men, which is a very intense movie, dystopian movie. And, you know, the art that we've had in films, you know, such as New York blowing up and L.A. blowing up, and starting with Mad Max a long time ago, I think it helps us see it, you know, many times. I'm hopeful that by these artists continuing to write and do films along this line that we can, you know, when we're supposedly entertaining ourselves, we're not listening to the news, but the films and the books inform us about the dangers. Yes, I mean, that Dakota Pipeline is you know, going to be putting all of that really nasty oil down here in the Gulf. You know, and of course, they're going to call it a jobs thing.
Courtney, we got it, and I appreciate your call a lot. I mean, maybe this kind of art goes all the way, it goes way back, of course. Maybe Noah and the Ark and a lot more than that. Not hard for Courtney to picture some of this, maybe from the American War setting and story. Alexandra, David. Alexandra, take us into another here, The Book of Joan from Lydia Yuknovich. What's the essential story?
So this is a fascinating novel that she says, when I spoke to her, she said it was partly inspired by the myth of Joan of Arc, but she was really looking, I think you mentioned a quote from the story early on, you know, she's really looking at where we're headed as a society, particularly when it comes to climate change and environmental destruction and the kind of economic stratification that we're seeing. And she was just imagining the sort of the extreme worst-case scenario of where this might be headed. In the novel, it's in the near future, wars have transformed the Earth into a battleground, and the Earth has been just destroyed by climate change and war. And the wealthy have retreated skyward. They've created this kind of suborbital space station out of space detritus, and they're living up there with these skylines that they've installed to kind of continue to extract resources from the Earth. And their leader is this celebrity billionaire turned tyrant, the despot. And in fact, when I spoke to Lydia, of course, she wasn't envisioning our current politics, but she said she was thinking about sort of the power that celebrities have and how she imagined even a couple years ago that at one point there might be a reality star celebrity type politician.
The retreat to the near Earth orbit sounds a little like Elysium, the Matt Damon film from not so many years ago.
Yes, I think so. It's interesting. I think there was another, you know, there was a reference, you referenced the Black Mirror episode where the poor are huddled underground, the rich are up on the surface. And in this case, the destitute are left behind on the ruined Earth, and the wealthy have taken up this sky residence. And it's kind of the physical manifestation of the divisions that we're seeing when it comes to wealth and economic disparity. And so in this novel, there is hope. There's a heroine named Joan who survives the war, although people have believed that she hasn't. You learn early on that she's survived, and she has these this power to kind of channel the energy of the Earth, natural energies and things like that. So it's part fantasy, part science fiction. But like a lot of these novels, as our caller mentioned, you know, I think speculative fiction and science fiction is such a powerful tool to kind of probe at things that are happening now. It feels escapist when you're reading it. It's not like looking at the news or TV, but it really does dig at some of the issues that we're dealing with right now.
David Higgins in St. Paul, there's another here, Zachary Mason's Void Star. And it's another, I don't know if you've read it, but it's another, I guess, where climate change has, as Alexander has it, rendered large swaths of the planet uninhabitable. Impoverished masses huddle in favelas in San Francisco and Los Angeles. But artificial intelligence comes in here, too, and that makes plenty of appearances in the dystopian future. Have you checked it out, David?
I'm not as familiar with Void Star, but I will say that many of the kind of dystopian books that we've been seeing over the last number of years are imagining sort of an inevitable catastrophe that unfolds from sort of climate change types of things. I think Courtney mentioned the book The Water Knife, which was by Paolo Bacigalupi, came out in 2015, and this book kind of imagines what it would be like in the American Southwest as water becomes more and more and more of a problem, and when it does, you see all these kinds of privatization efforts that unfold, and then corporations and states start going to war with one another over just how the water's going to work. And it ends up being very similar to what Alexandra was talking about in the Book of Joan, where you know, the wealthy get wealthier as a result of all of these kinds of problems and are able to find a place where they can escape and take refuge, others are not. They're sort of left with the consequences. You see that, I think, also with Kim Stanley Robinson's book, New York 2140.
Yeah. I mean, in Void Star, we've got private armies for the rich, armored, self-driving cars. They're undergoing life-extending medical treatments. We were just talking about that in Silicon Valley here last week. And then this angle of a computer scientist who has envisioned, the author, Zachary Mason, has envisioned this world where boundaries, Alexander writes, between machines and people have grown increasingly porous, and a powerful godlike artificial intelligence hacks into people's minds. Jackson in Norman, Oklahoma. Jackson, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was interested in your conversation because I'd recently read an article that I can no longer remember what from, but the author seemed to suggest that the rise in dystopian fiction actually might have a lot of roots in escapist literature more so than any kind of social critique. They pointed to the rise of, like, zombie-type dystopias where consequences are no longer something that you have to be worried about. You can commit to actions without fear of reprisal or even kind of social issues. You referenced Black Mirror. They have an episode regarding how social media seems to control our lives and dictate our actions, and the protagonist is only really free at the end when they kind of just utterly reject that sort of control. So,
Jackson, let us pick up this idea of dystopian fiction as sometimes escapist. It seems counterintuitive in some ways because escape to what? A kind of hell on earth. But maybe. Alexander Alter, David Higgins, stand by. Christopher Robichaud joins me right now in the studio, professor of ethics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, teaches a course on dystopias and utopias in fiction and philosophy. Christopher Robichaud, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So dystopian fiction, on the face of it, you'd say, well, that's not escapist. It's so miserable. Is it in some way escapist, or is it rubbing our nose in what may come?
I mean, I can imagine some people viewing it as escapist. I don't view it as escapist. You know, these days, my Facebook feed and my Twitter feed reads like an avant-garde dystopian novel, and so I don't consider it escapist at all. But I understand the point of the caller. I mean, one of the things that I do in my course is distinguish between apocalyptic literature, post-apocalyptic literature, and dystopian literature.
Okay, give us the line.
Yeah, it's not a hard distinction. There's some blur, but. Apocalyptic literature, like zombie apocalypses and Mad Max, tends to invite us to consider what we are like, what humanity's like in the absence of government.
Mm-hmm.
What's our nature?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas dystopian literature, I think, imagines a government that's abusing us in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Or a power structure
like corporations or so forth that's abusing us in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And those are distinct. They're connected in some ways, but they are distinct. And they do invite us – one invites us to really look inward at ourselves. What is our nature? One invites us to look at the political institutions that we have created or might create.
Alexandra, reading the group that you pulled together here, they seem more in the dystopian camp. I mean, this is about power structures gone wrong.
Often, but I think there is an overlap here a little bit because in both American War by Amiral Lacaud and in Lydia Yuknovich's The Book of Joan, it's sort of these catastrophes that allow either a tyrant to rise or cause democracy to crumble. And so there is the element of some sort of political catastrophe following kind of a environmental or global catastrophe or a war because the chaos sort of allows certain forces to take hold.
And they certainly two, and it's not pretty. David Higgins, you mentioned Kim Stanley Robinson's New York 2140. I mean, Alexandra's sitting there, so we're hoping this isn't happening right now. But this is...
everything looks good so far.
Oh, good. Okay. Lower Manhattan sinks into the sea, and what? The city, at least those who can afford it, retreat to the high skyscrapers, and they're sort of getting around by boat and skybridge and zipline and dirigible. And high finance goes on in this novel, David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what you see in New York 2140. You know, it's interesting kind of talking about this difference between escapist dystopian fiction and if there's something else. You know, I think that one of the things that you kind of see in the difference between these different kinds of books is some of them are kind of optimistic utopias that imagine that there might be some sort of change that's possible, like The Hunger Games, you know, kind of mm-hmm. goes in that direction. A lot of the YA dystopias actually have got that sort of sense of heroic agency, like, you know, things might suck, but you're going to be able to do something that's going to make a difference. A lot of these other books, though, I think they're much more pessimistic dystopias that are kind of, you know, you know, they're pointing towards these problems, but they're not really clear, you know, on what might happen. Kim Stanley Robinson imagines this world where derivatives traders are basically profiting off of the rising sea levels caused by climate change. And because they're sort of locked into that, the problem is going to keep going on and on. And he offers kind of a hopeful solution for a little bit. Basically, a couple of characters are able to dig up some gold that has sunk from a Revolutionary War vessel in the New York Harbor, and they're able to use it and leverage it into a financial instrument that they used to sort of basically crash the markets and try to start everything over. But you know, at the end, he sort of ends with this note on basically saying, "Well, that's sort of temporary, and our economic systems really sort of thrive on those kinds of crises, and it's going to be difficult to find any kind of change that's going to be more meaningful."
And Christopher, what sort of chapter of dystopian fiction do you see us as in right now, as opposed to earlier periods, eras?
Well, I mean, I don't. Comedy aside, I'm hoping we aren't in a dystopia quite yet. In part because I think that last point was exactly right. Most dystopias are pessimistic.
I'm not asking about the real world we're in, though it's always related. I'm asking about the fictional world that's the texture of the dystopian novels and fiction that's out there right now.
So there's a few things that I've been noticing in dystopian fiction that's kind of interesting. First of all, just from a literary standpoint, is that older dystopias tended to be a tour through the dystopia, modeling themselves off of utopias. You know, here's the world. Here's our protagonist. We're going to have this protagonist sort of show us the world, but the mm-hmm. bulk of the work was showing us the world. That's 1984. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there's some plot to 1984, mm-hmm. obviously, but it's not the focus, right? Mm-hmm. Dystopias like the Water Knife more recently, United Airlines, some of these books that I look forward to reading that are coming, you know, hot off the press. There is more narrative lift to them. There's a story to be told. Sometimes it's a mystery. And so one thing that I'm noticing is that they engage the readers more. You know, they draw you in more. Let's mm-hmm. figure out what's going on in a way that I didn't see some old utopias or dystopias doing.
Is there more or less heroic agency these days?
Yeah, so I agree that a lot of the YA books that are dystopias have that kind of heroic agency.
Katniss can go out there with her bow and her brains and make things happen.
Understandably so. I mean, I don't know if it's really entirely useful to have kids read a bunch of books in which there's nothing but despair and ruin.
I'm
a professional philosopher, that's fine by my standards.
Come on, kids. We can work this out.
Right, but eventually you want some hope at the end.
Yeah.
But I do think it's really telling that a lot of the books that we're seeing, which has been mentioned already, do envision a world in which something catastrophic climate-wise has happened, and the question is only what are we doing to cope with it? And in that sense, these new dystopias are pretty pessimistic in that they think that the seeds have been planted and will soon blossom into some pretty awful things. Oligarchies, the reduction of any kind of effective government, the advent of global climate catastrophes. And then the question just becomes how bad will it be, not whether bad things will happen.
Alexander, what about the ratio between heroic agency to push back and straight up pessimism in what you've been seeing?
That's a great question. There are a couple, I think, of slightly more hopeful dystopias that we're seeing coming out right now. Of course, New York 2140 is one of them, because although New York is submerged, partly underwater, it's still a vibrant city, and
New Venice.
People are going about their lives.
Yeah.
And similarly, Cory Doctorow's Walkaway, which is coming out this spring as well, it's not out yet, but it is about a society where, you know, the rich, the gulf between the rich and the poor is so enormous that some people decide they're just going to opt out of society and walk away.
But hold the thought, Alexander. A short break right here. Christopher Robichaud, David Higgins, we're talking about the new wave of dystopian fiction. You can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the dystopian fiction flooding the book market right now. Publishers and readers going for novels of this world gone very wrong. Alexander Alter with the New York Times is with us. Christopher Robichaud is here from Harvard, looks at philosophy and pop culture and superhero literature and dystopian fiction. David Higgins is here, writes for the Los Angeles Review of Books, joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota today. You can join us as well. Is your dystopian reading in the daily real world news headlines now? Do we go to dystopian fiction to scare ourselves, to imagine tomorrow, to think about what we don't want to do or see? And do these writers put words to your fears? Hunger Games, of course, has been out there, incredibly successful. You got your Katniss Everdeen, played by Jennifer Lawrence in the movies of it, preparing to go to war against, in the movies, against the tyrannical President Snow, played by Donald Sutherland. Here's a little bit from Mockingjay Part 2. Out a couple of years ago, President Snow appears on television in a broadcast labeled Mandated Viewing and orders all citizens to gather in the Capitol and lashes out at the rebels.
Our enemy is not like us. They do not share our values. They have never known our comfort and our sophistication, and they despise us for it. Make no mistake. They are not coming to liberate us. They are coming to destroy our way of life. They are coming to bury us.
Sounds weirdly familiar. Lauren in Tampa, Florida. Lauren, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What do you see? Are you reading this stuff?
Ironically enough, the last series of that nature I read was the Hunger Games series, and I did enjoy it. And one of the things that I've started to realize is, you know, as I've gotten older, I'm 53, that art has, you know, almost always imitated life anyway. And so these books have always kind of hit home for me in the what-if category. What could happen? But I think the thing that's really starting to take root for a lot of readers is that we can now very much imagine it here. Before, it was a distant land or a distant place. Even some of the things that tried to really base fiction on life, it was somewhere else, because we haven't had, other than our own Civil War, huge war or huge acts of terrorism that have really destroyed our landscape. So when I put my mind to it and I think of these dystopias here, as I've gotten older, they've become more and more
Are you still reading dystopian fiction, Lauren?
No, I'm very, very much into the reality that we're living right now, and it seems to be enough for me. It feeds my imagination every day how the American people could have been duped so badly.
Well, I mean, here we are. People see it all kinds of ways. To you, it seems maybe the headlines read like dystopian fiction. I appreciate your call. One more right here. Jason in Rapid City, South Dakota. Jason, you're on.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to call to voice my support for the gentleman who said that it was a bit of escapism
that was making the dystopian novel so popular, because I'm no longer a disgruntled youth, but when I was a disgruntled youth, and you see the insanity around you of the politics that were going on, of climate change, disease, all of these scary, scary things. And as a youth, you think, gosh, if we could just start over. And in a lot of these dystopian novels, I think particularly of Margaret Atwood, I think of Stephen King's The Stand, and novels like that, where you have this opportunity to rebuild as you see fit. And I think that for me as a youth, was one of the things that really appealed to me about that type of novel. And I have discovered, as I've gotten older...
What vast age have you reached now, Jason? What enormous age have you reached?
I've just turned 40 this past year, and now that I've got two children,
okay.
I don't want the world to burn anymore. You know, I don't want to rebuild. I want to preserve what we have and make it cleaner. So that was just the point I wanted to make, that I can see why it was escapist for some folks and that desire to rebuild.
If it's there, I appreciate your call, Jason. Alexandra, what about Cory Doctorow's Walk Away? You said there's some kind of silver lining there. What's it's not?
Yeah,
what's
I would say, you know, some people have even used the word utopian to describe this book. It's not out yet, but it's coming out this spring, and it is again kind of this society. You know, modern society is broken down. The world has been wrecked by climate change. Cities have been hollowed out by industrial flight. There's massive disparity between the wealthy and the poor. But the silver lining is that there's technology that's available so that you can print your own clothes and find food and shelter. And so there's a certain class of society that decides they're just going to kind of opt out.
The walkaways, in other words. Yeah.
Exactly. And what's interesting, I think, is, you know, you see in some of these novels, even though there's little control, you know, there's not that heroic agency that you see in the YA dystopian novels. Mm-hmm. There is still a sense of hope and purpose. And so it's sort of, you know, if the world is wrecked and civilization is crumbled, can you still find love? Can you still find meaning? Can you sort of take comfort in the connections that you have with other people? And another novel that I didn't include in my recent article, but I wrote about earlier this year that I think fits into that category very well, is Exit West by Mohsin Hamid. And that's, again, kind of in the nearish future, or almost like now. And that is about this world where there's a global refugee crisis, and these migrants are able to move seamlessly through magic doors to get to the West from wherever they're trapped. And there's a couple that manages to escape this Middle Eastern city that's been torn apart by sectarian warfare. And while it's a really depressing book and it speaks to a lot of the problems we're seeing in the world right now, there's kind of these Western nationalist movements that are opposed to taking in refugees and the like. There's still this sense that even when they've lost everything, the protagonists are able to find purpose in their lives. And that's what he was aiming to do with the book.
Christopher, what about the opt-out option in dystopian fiction? Does it show up more or less depending on whether there's hope? Or is it dangled as a desire?
I think it's often used to tempt the protagonists. And we ourselves embrace that temptation. I mean, I'm thinking of the classic, you know, Winston 1984. Mm-hmm. You know, they try to find love. Mm-hmm. They try to get out, even if getting out is just getting out into a room where they have privacy. But often we learn that there is no escape. Often we learn that it was all an illusion. And so this goes back to what I mentioned before. The challenge of dystopias is that they're telling us that a political set of institutions have been put in place that are often suffocating, and by political institutions that could be corporations and so forth. And so it's very hard to escape those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so opting out is always something desirable when you think about it, but hard to achieve.
We've got NK3 from Michael Tolkien. David Higgins, have you checked it out?
I'm not as familiar with NK3, no. But can I respond to one thing that came up? Is that all right?
Yeah, it's all right.
Yeah. I was just going to say the caller just who called in, the first of the callers, she said, you know, it's really powerful that we can imagine we can imagine those things happening to us in mm-hmm. a way that we hadn't previously. And that's sort of one of the reasons for this dystopian kind of sentiment right now. I completely agree with that. And at the same time, I also want to say, like, I think that there are many people in the United States for whom these things have been happening. And that kind of goes along with what Christopher's saying about dystopia being about, like, experiencing this abuse of power, right? I think there's a great argument to be made that some of those powerful dystopian novels right now are like Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me mm-hmm. or J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, which are both nonfiction memoirs mm-hmm. that really map out the way in which, you know, government power or some systems of power, right, are abusing us or harming us in these ways. And you see that like in American War, right? The author, Mr. Ellicott, he said, you know, and this is from Alexandra's review. She said, I don't think there's much in this book that hasn't happened. It's just happened elsewhere. And so this sort of, there's a kind of popping of what James Baldwin used to sort of call a bubble of innocence, right? Mm-hmm. This sort of ability to imagine that those things aren't happening. Well, now it's like everyone's eyes are being opened to the fact that these things are happening and have been happening. They just haven't necessarily been happening to us. So, and there's sort of a expansion of empathy there.
Got it. I mean, he served in Afghanistan or worked in Afghanistan and saw there, brings that kind of eye back here and thinks about an American Civil War. But Christopher David raises in Ta-Nehisi Coates, that's not a dystopian future. He's writing about his life now. Hillbilly Elegy, that's now as well. Of course, fiction always points out the things that are troubling and amiss in our current reality as well. But where's the line between dystopian fiction and just the reality we're living in? Is it becoming blurrier?
It is becoming a little blurrier, but some of the people who we've listened to today who have called in and mm-hmm. the conversation has mentioned that fiction helps us to imaginatively engage our reality. That's sort of the trick that it does. It's made up, but the best fiction is made up in a way in which there are important truths that are nonetheless communicated. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly the sort of thing that we're seeing with some of this. I completely agree that one of the books that I taught last year was United Airlines, which imagines an alternative history where the United States never entirely got rid of slavery. And that's by Ben Winters, I believe. Mm-hmm. Right? And the challenge of that book is, you know, here's a fictional United States in which slavery still exists, but it's quite clear that one of the questions that the fiction invites us to consider is how much worse is that United States than the one in which we are currently living when you read things like Between the World and Us, right? Ta-Nehisi Coates.
You have people stuck in an underclass.
Right. When you see systemic racism exist, mm-hmm. it's not as in your face, but it's nonetheless quite oppressive. Right. Of course, it is in some people's faces. The whole point of it is it's not as obvious as still having slave states, but it can be quite as oppressive. So I do think that a lot of these fictions ask us to imaginatively engage our current situation.
Emily in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Emily, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. What do you see?
So what I'm interested in is the difference in how the protagonist brings you through the world. I tend to read more classic dystopian literature, and I'm very interested when you have a character who doesn't understand how bad their world is and then is kind of realizing it along with you, the reader, as opposed to novels where the protagonist already knows how bad it is and is kind of letting you in, and the kind of isolation you feel as the reader knowing that they know but you don't, and then you're slowly being let in. And I'm curious as to whether the more contemporary dystopian novels fall into one camp or the other.
David Higgins, what do you say?
Well, you know, I think that kind of goes back to that clip from Margaret Atwood about awakening, right? I was sleeping and now I'm being mm-hmm. awakened, mm-hmm. right? I think that especially in the YA tradition, you see this sort of matrix-like progression from not understanding that things are a certain way to, you know, some sort of revelation of the dark gothic underbelly of truth of the dystopian society mm-hmm. that you're living in, right? Mm-hmm. And I do think that you see that a lot. Other books, though, well, you know, I mean, I think that other books, they take it for granted as the sort of, you know, starting situation. But I think a trend that runs through all of these is really a kind of communicating to us in stages, layers of things that are bad that we haven't been paying attention to, and now we can't stop paying attention to them.
There's so much from the headlines. NK3 by Michael Tolkien, and you've got fences, walls, 60-foot tall fence surrounding the hills in L.A., Hollywood, where the rich used to live. The mansion's taken over by those with the power of memory because North Korea somehow had weaponized a microbe that accidentally spread around the globe. It deletes human memory. That makes the way back to some kind of Eden tougher and tougher. Nancy in Dearborn, Michigan. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Nancy.
Thank you.
What do you see out there?
I'm a college professor, and I'm emeritus, but I am also still teaching, and I'm still teaching because in large part of this election. I did assign 1984 after the election results. It's an online class, and my students, basically, I was careful because I didn't want to impose my views on them, but they picked up right away on many of the parallels of what's going on in our country now. Newspeak, and the whole idea of alternative facts, the rewriting of history. And I would say with the two speakers, one call-in and one of your guests who said mm-hmm. that the arts and so forth are so important to give us a picture of what could be, and I have been fighting that fight my whole teaching life, and I continue to do that. I fear for the arts.
George Orwell, way back when, giving everybody a heads up with 1984, and you still doing it with your classes today. Let me get one more. Dawn in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dawn, you're on. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm a second wave feminist, and with everything that's been going on, the younger generation who I deal with and that I help teach, I've been showing them Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Institute. And the third wave feminists have felt, you know, the need to speak up and to resist. But after reading that, they're so much more involved in actively resisting because the signs are frankly there.
Active resistance coming from reading dystopian fiction. Our time is short, but I appreciate your call, Dawn. Alexandra, you've surveyed a lot of this. Does it seem to you as though this is a provocation to act, or does it overwhelm and make people pacified?
That's a great question, and that was something I was wondering myself when I saw this really kind of intense cluster of books that share some of these concerns and themes, is whether people might feel a little bit of fatigue when it comes to dystopian fiction. You know, it does seem escapist and fun when things are going okay, but if the news is so distressing, maybe they want to pick up something else when it's time to relax and read a book. But I do think the intention of the novelists, and the ones that I interviewed for the story at least, was to instill a sense of empathy in the reader. And if not to kind of lead them to take political action, at least to instill that kind of understanding of what it's like to be a victim of some of these things, or to imagine, what we might do differently to avoid going down these paths.
Maybe. Lots of these books coming to a shelf near you, or a download in your hand. Really interesting to see this coming and now, and to hear about it. Alexandra Alter with the New York Times, thank you very much for being with us today, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christopher Robichaud at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thanks a lot for coming in, Christopher.
Thank you so much.
And David Higgins with the Los Angeles Review of Books, joining us today from St. Paul. David, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Read with courage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.